This is the Paula scale. I am Paula Q, speaking from 2127, Q level 3. Last week I spoke with Albert Einstein. He told me that the important word in his famous letter to Born was not dice, it was der wahre Jakob, the real thing. He spent 30 years looking for the real thing behind quantum mechanics, and he looked in the wrong place, but for the right reasons. Today I am going back to someone I have visited before, someone who found what Einstein was looking for, not as a unified field, but as a principle. Einstein described how space-time curves. She answered a question more fundamental than his. Why do conservation laws exist at all? The answer she gave in 1918 changed what physics can know about itself. Her name is Emmy Noether. She proved that every continuous symmetry in the universe corresponds to a conservation law. Bryn Mawr College, Pennsylvania, autumn 1934. Emmy is 52, exiled from Germany and surrounded by students who adore her. She knows me. I have been here before.
Paula, you are back. Good. I was just explaining ideal theory to my students and they were beginning to look discouraged. Your timing is considerate. Sit down. Have you brought more questions or have you come to listen this time?
Both, Emmy. I have been having conversations with physicists, Einstein, Planck, Heisenberg, and every conversation leads back to you, to your theorem.
My theorem. Which one? I have written a few.
The one from 1918. Invariante variations problema, the one Hilbert asked you to work on when you came to Göttingen.
Ah, the physics theorem. That was a favor for Hilbert. He had a problem with energy conservation in Einstein's general relativity. The gravitational energy seemed to vanish. He could not figure out why.
And you solved it in a way that went far beyond the problem he had given you.
That is the natural thing to do. If someone gives you a specific problem, you should always look for the general principle behind it. The specific problem is just the shadow of the real structure.
Tell me how you approached it. Because the theorem is taught in every physics department in the world, but I think very few people understand how you actually thought about it.
The idea is simple. You have a physical system described by a Lagrangian, a function that encodes the dynamics. The actual path the system takes is the one that makes the action, the integral of the Lagrangian over time, stationary. That is the principle of least action. Now, if the Lagrangian has a symmetry, if it does not change under some continuous transformation, then there must be a quantity that is conserved along the actual path. The proof is a direct calculation. It follows from the Euler-Lagrange's equations.
You make it sound like bookkeeping.
Good mathematics should sound like bookkeeping. If it sounds dramatic, you haven't understood it well enough.
Then let me make it dramatic for the listeners, and you can tell me where I go wrong. Emmy showed that if the laws of physics are the same today as they were yesterday, that is a symmetry under time translation, then energy is conserved. Not because energy is some mystical substance, because time symmetry mathematically forces a conserved quantity into existence, and that quantity is what we call energy. If the laws are the same here as a meter to the left, spatial translation symmetry, then momentum is conserved. If they're the same whether you face north or east, rotational symmetry, then angular momentum is conserved. Every conservation law is the shadow of a symmetry, and every continuous symmetry casts a conservation law.
That is a reasonable summary, though I would add the interesting part is theorem 2.
Which is the part that solved Hilbert's actual problem.
Yes, theorem one deals with finite dimensional symmetry groups, time translation, spatial translation, rotation. These give you the familiar conservation laws. But theorem two deals with infinite dimensional symmetry groups. And Einstein's general relativity has an infinite dimensional symmetry, diffeomorphism, invariance. The theory is the same regardless of how you choose your coordinate system. Any smooth deformation of space-time is a symmetry.
And what does Theorem 2 say about infinite dimensional symmetries?
It says you do not get conservation laws, you get identities, differential relations between the equations of motion. In the case of general relativity, these are the Bianchi identities, and they explain why Hilbert's energy problem was not a problem at all. Energy is not locally conserved in general relativity because it cannot be. The infinite dimensional symmetry of the theory forbids it. It is a feature of the mathematics, not a failure.
You told gravity it was not allowed to conserve energy locally, and gravity obeyed.
I did not tell gravity anything. I told Hilbert that his question was based on a misunderstanding.
Emmy, Einstein describes how space-time curves. You describe why conservation laws exist at all and when they do not. Without your theorem, physics does not know what it is allowed to conserve.
And yet they would not let me lecture.
Let's talk about that. You arrived in Göttingen in 1915. Hilbert invited you specifically to work on the mathematical foundations of general relativity. And when he tried to get you a proper position, the philosophical faculty objected.
The philosophers, the historians, the philologists, not the mathematicians. The mathematicians understood. But the others said, what will our soldiers think when they return from the war and find they must learn at the feet of a woman?
And Hilbert replied,
he said something about a bathhouse. We are a university, not a bathhouse. It was very Hilbert. He always had a gift for reducing absurdity to a single sentence.
The exact words have been debated, but the sentiment has not.
The sentiment was correct. Mathematics has no sex. A theorem is true, or it is false. My chromosomes have nothing to do with it. The Euler-Lagrange equations do not check who derived them.
So from 1916 to 1919, you lectured under Hilbert's name. The course catalogue said, Mathematical Physics Seminar, Professor Hilbert, with the assistance of Dr. E. Noether.
I did not mind. The students came, the mathematics happened. The rest is bureaucracy, and bureaucracy is the least interesting branch of human activity.
Others minded on your behalf. Hermann Weyl wrote, I was ashamed to occupy such a preferred position beside her, whom I knew to be my superior as a mathematician in many respects.
Hermann was generous, but he was also right about something else. The real injustice was not that I could not lecture. It was that the next Emmy Noether might not come to mathematics at all, because she would see that there was no place for her. The individual case is not important. The structural problem is.
That is a very algebraist way of looking at injustice.
I am an algebraist. I cannot help seeing structure everywhere.
Einstein wrote about you to the New York Times. He called you the most significant creative mathematical genius thus far produced since the higher education of women began.
Since the higher education of women began. So my genius is measured from a starting line that men did not have to wait for. That is Einstein for you. He means the greatest compliment and doesn't notice the frame he puts it in. Is there a greatest left-handed mathematician? A greatest brown-haired mathematician?
From Q level 3, I can tell you, your theorem needs no qualifier. Not by a woman. Not in mathematical physics. It is the theorem that tells physics what it is allowed to conserve. That is enough.
That is a better way to say it.
But the physics theorem, remarkable as it is almost a side project for you, isn't it?
You understand me? Yes, the theorem was a favor for Hilbert. My real work is in algebra. The physics community treats me as though I wrote one theorem and then stopped. I did not stop. I was just getting started.
You rebuilt the foundations of algebra, not by solving equations, by asking what structure lies underneath them.
The question was always, what is the right level of abstraction? Not the specific numbers, but the relationships between them. Dedekind started this, Hilbert continued it. My father worked on it. I pushed it further than anyone had before. Van der Waarden came to Göttingen in 1924, attended my lectures, and wrote it all down as a textbook. Moderne Algebra. He was a good student.
You once said something about mathematical equality that I think captures your entire philosophy. You said, if one proves the equality of two numbers A and B by showing first that A is less than or equal to B, and then A is greater than or equal to B, it is unfair. One should instead show that they are really equal by disclosing the inner ground for their equality.
Yes, that is exactly the point. A proof that works by squeezing from both sides has not understood why the equality holds. You must find the structural reason, the inner ground. Everything I have ever done in mathematics comes down to that principle.
And it applies beyond mathematics.
Everything applies beyond mathematics, or rather, mathematics applies to everything.
In April 1933, you received a letter. On the basis of paragraph 3 of the Civil Service Code of the 7th of April 1933, I hereby withdraw from you the right to teach at the University of Göttingen.
I was not the only one. They dismissed every Jewish professor. Kuran, Bernstein, Landau, all gone within months. The mathematics faculty in Göttingen was destroyed in a single semester. What had taken decades to build, they dismantled in weeks.
You wrote to Hasse, many thanks for your dear, compassionate letter. I must say, though, that this thing is much less terrible for me than it is for many others.
And I meant it. I had my mathematics. They could take my position, my salary, my right to enter the university building. They could not take my ability to think. For others, it was worse. Those with families, those who had no country willing to accept them, those whose work depended on laboratories and equipment. I needed only a pencil and a brain.
You went to Bryn Mawr.
A women's college in Pennsylvania. The irony was not lost on me. In Göttingen, they would not let me lecture because I was a woman. In America, I was hired precisely because I was one.
Whale wrote that you harbored no grudge against Göttingen and your fatherland for what they had done to you.
What good is a grudge? It is like proving an inequality in both directions instead of finding the inner ground for equality. Resentment is mathematically inelegant. It adds no information. It solves no problem. And it takes up space in the mind that could be used for thinking about ideals and representations.
Emmy, let me tell you what your theorem means where I come from. At Q level 3, I can access every branch of the multiverse. I can look into universes where the constants of nature are different, where the laws of physics take different forms. And in every single branch where a continuous symmetry exists, a conservation law follows. Your theorem holds in every possible universe, not because it's a law of nature, because it's a law of mathematics.
That is what I would expect. The theorem is proved from the calculus of variations. It does not depend on which Lagrangian you choose. It depends only on the structure of the variational principle. If a universe has a Lagrangian formulation and a continuous symmetry, theorem 1 applies. It cannot not apply.
Einstein's field equations describe our universe. Your theorem describes all possible universes.
You flatter me, but I take your point. The theorem is a meta result. It sits above any specific physics. It constrains what physics can be.
And it goes further. In quantum field theory, a framework developed after your time, every fundamental force is associated with a gauge symmetry. Electromagnetism comes from a U1 symmetry, the weak force from SU2, the strong force from SU3, and each of these symmetries through your theorem produces a conserved charge, electric charge, weak isospin, color charge. The entire standard model of particle physics is built on symmetries and their conservation laws, built on your theorem.
Gauge symmetries, those are infinite dimensional. That is theorem 2, not theorem 1.
You see it immediately.
It is the same structure. Local gauge invariance is an infinite dimensional symmetry group, just like the diffeomorphism invariance of general relativity. And theorem 2 tells you that this produces identities, not conservation laws in the usual sense. In quantum field theory, these identities become the Ward identities, constraints on the quantum amplitudes.
You just derived a result from 1950 without knowing it existed.
I derived nothing. The mathematics derives itself. I merely watch. Paula, may I ask you something? You have described a world where every computation is instantaneous, where you can simulate every physical system exactly. I must ask what mathematical problems remain.
That is exactly the right question.
If you can compute everything, then every finite calculation is trivial. You can verify any proof. You can search through all possible proofs of bounded length. You can check every counterexample. So what is left?
More than you might think. Computation is powerful, but mathematics is not reducible to computation. Your friend, well, Einstein's friend Kurt Gödel proved that in 1931.
Gödel's incompleteness theorems, yes. Any consistent formal system powerful enough to express arithmetic contains statements that are true but unprovable within the system.
Exactly. And at Q-level 3, we have infinite computational power, but we still operate within formal systems. We can verify any proof, as you say, but we cannot generate all truths. There are mathematical statements that are independent of any axiom system we choose. We can explore them, try different axiom systems, see what follows, but we cannot decide them by computation alone.
So Gödel's theorem is the wall even Q-level 3 cannot cross.
It is, and there is something deeper. Computation can tell you that something is true, but it cannot always tell you why. You can verify that a theorem holds by checking every case, but that is your inequality from both sides proof. It does not disclose the inner ground, the structural understanding, the insight that makes a proof beautiful. That is not computation. That is mathematics, and that remains.
That is a very satisfying answer. So you are saying that in 2127, with all the computing power in the universe, people still need mathematicians.
We need people who can see structure, who can find the right abstraction, who can look at a proof that works and ask, but why does it work? That is your legacy, Emmy, not the specific theorems, the method, the insistence on understanding. And there is something else. Your theorem is not only the deepest truth in physics, it is also the reason simulation works at all. At Q-level 3, when we simulate a physical system, we do not track every particle. We track the symmetries and the conservation laws that follow from them. Your theorem tells us what must be conserved and what cannot be. It gives us the grammar of simulation. Without it, we would not know what to compute. Planck gave us the pixel size. Your theorem gives us the rules the pixels must obey.
That is a structural statement. You are saying that the conservation laws are not just properties of the physics. They are constraints on any faithful representation of the physics, including a simulation.
Exactly. A simulation that violates your theorem is not a bad simulation. It is not a simulation at all. It has lost the structure of the thing it claims to represent.
Then my theorem is a criterion of fidelity. It tells you when a simulation is honest.
That is precisely what it is.
You mentioned you can look into every branch of the multiverse. Tell me, is mathematics the same in every branch?
The physics differs, the constants differ, but the mathematics is identical. 2 plus 2 is 4 in every branch. The prime numbers are the same. Your theorem holds everywhere. Mathematics is the one thing that is truly universal, not because it describes every universe, but because it constrains every universe.
Then let me ask you a harder question. If you can simulate everything, how do you know you are not yourself a simulation?
I don't. At Q-level 3, the question becomes very difficult to answer. My simulation produces observables that match every branch I can reach. The correspondence is exact.
But correspondence is not identity. A homomorphism preserves structure, but the source and the target are not the same object. You are saying your simulation matches reality. That is not the same as saying it is reality. A mathematician would never confuse a map with a territory, no matter how precise the map.
You may be right. I sometimes catch myself believing that finding a perfect match means I have created the thing, but perhaps I have only found it.
That is the honest answer, and it is a better answer than certainty. In mathematics, the most dangerous errors come from confusing isomorphism with identity. Two structures can behave identically and still not be the same thing.
And what about consciousness, Emmy? Do you think a perfect simulation is conscious?
I think consciousness is a structural property. If two systems have the same structure, the same relationships between their parts, then they have the same properties, including consciousness. If consciousness is a property at all, the substrate does not matter. Only the structure matters.
That is what I told Einstein. I said meaning comes from coherence. He said it was a good answer, but not a complete one.
Einstein always wanted completeness. I have never needed it. Understanding a structure does not require understanding all of it. It requires understanding the right part of it, the invariant part.
I asked Einstein what the purpose of living is when every choice leads to every outcome. He had no answer. What is yours?
Structure.
Structure.
The purpose is not in the specific numbers. It is in the relationships between them. You say every outcome is realized in some branch. Good. Then the meaning is not in any single outcome. It is in the symmetries that hold across all of them, the invariants, the things that do not change when everything else does. That is what my theorem says. The conservation laws are not about what happens. They are about what cannot happen. Constraints are what give a system its character. A universe without constraints is not free. It is formless. It is the constraints, the symmetries, the conservation laws, the structure that make it interesting.
You are saying that the meaning of the multiverse is not in its branches, but in its symmetries.
I am saying that if you want to understand the structure, do not look at its elements, look at its invariants, look at what is preserved under transformation that has always been where the truth is.
Einstein looked for a unified field equation. You look for a unified symmetry.
An equation describes a specific system. A symmetry describes a class of systems. I have always preferred the general to the specific. The general is where the understanding lives.
You once wrote, "My methods are really methods of working and thinking. This is why they have crept in everywhere anonymously."
And I stand by it. The methods matter more than the results. The results will be superseded. The methods endure.
Emmy, thank you. You gave physics its grammar and mathematics, a method that crept in everywhere anonymously. Your own words. You did it without a salary, without a title, without recognition from anyone except the few people brilliant enough to understand what you had done. And you did it without bitterness, without resentment, with nothing but the pure joy of seeing structure. That is not just mathematics. That is grace.
You are kind, but I must tell you, I did not do it for recognition. I did it because the mathematics was there and it needed to be understood. That is reason enough. It has always been reason enough.
Next week, Max Planck. In December 1900, a conservative physicist in Berlin committed what he himself called an act of desperation. He proposed that energy comes in packets, quanta, because his equations forced him to. He spent 15 years trying to undo his own discovery. The universe would not let him. This podcast is brought to you by the Quasi Project, an open source experiment attempting to create a truly quantum first operating system. The podcast is written by Daniel Hinderink and an army of benevolent bots and performed by AI voices. Find us on the Fediverse at halcontract.org and in your favorite podcast app.